This is a subject that the tide of physics has washed over and receded from, and therefore it's a subject that I enjoy working in, a sort of peaceful backwater of science. Let me start with an outline of what I propose to talk about. I'm going to give you probably most of the talk will be devoted to background. The background of viscoelasticity in general, that is, how do you measure it, at least as a theorist might envisage a measurement. What are the molecular formulas that relate the measurements to an understanding of the system you study, and so on. Then viscoelasticity is shown experimentally for polymer melts. And these polymers are chain polymers, strings, although I hesitate to use that word at this place. Strings are spaghetti, cooked spaghetti, not uncooked spaghetti, all entangled in a concentrated solution or melt, a molten glob of polymer, that is. Then the reptation model, the famous reptation model of DeGene and Adoy and Edwards, particularly, although people who were in the polymer business before those guys will find you many literature citations of the snake-like motion of polymer chains through an entangled melt. But those guys put it on a qualitative basis. Then objections to the model based on experiment, that is, what or how does the reptation model in its predictions fail to agree with experiments. I'll mention a few of those, but not at great length. It's more the nature of the assumptions that would bother you, or a few people anyway, even if the experiment were in perfect agreement with the theory. I might phrase around in this subject. One of the most common ploys on the part of the theorist is to say the experiments are wrong, and that's not something you hear very often. But I think it is in this case possibly relevant. And then finally, the simulations that I have been doing for a long time, with very few bottom lines reached to understand the nature of the assumptions and their validity. Okay. Sorry?
You said you've been doing with very few
bottom lines reached. Yeah, that is positive results. Or even really strong negative results, which would have pleased me equally, or more. Okay, background. Imagine a piece of a system of interest confined between two surfaces. If you want to get a bit realistic, you might imagine that these two surfaces, surface 1 and surface 2, are the boundaries of an annular region between two concentric cylinders. People don't actually do the experiments on melts or concentrated solutions with such a geometry, but you can at least imagine the possibility of it. Two surfaces, and here's the system of interest, or a section of it. And you now imagine that at time zero, the top surface is moved to your right, and the bottom surface is moved to your left. So that, presuming that the system sticks to the surface, it acquires a geometry like that. It undergoes a deformation. And the usual assumption, which may be questioned but rarely is that any point, any physical point or material point, as the continuum mechanicians like to call it, undergoes an instantaneous affine deformation in which you may describe the motion. I'll be using a double underline for second rank tensors or dyadics. You may describe the motion in this way, where r is the vector position of that point, and epsilon is something, for the way I've drawn it, something like a unit vector in the x direction times a unit vector in the y direction, this being x and this being y. And by the way, if you can't hear me clearly, please tell me, because I can't hear myself clearly. I've got some kind of an ear problem these last few weeks, and my voice sounds weird to me, so it may sound weird to you. Anyway, the initial affine deformation looks like that. That is what happens to the spatial positions. Now what happens to the forces in the system? Well, the forces in a continuum such as we first imagined this to be are described typically by a volume density, a force per unit volume, F. I'm going to use the same notation to describe the system at a microscopic level, and the implicit variables, the positions of all the atoms in the system, will simply be understood and not sketched on the blackboard. In any event, one imagines that at this continuum level, at least, the force density can be described in terms of a stress tensor. In other words, in saying that the force density is the divergence of a stress tensor, you're saying implicitly that the forces on any element of volume are exerted on the boundaries of that volume. And in particular here, they're exerted at these two surfaces. And you have an expression for this macroscopic stress tensor. And you would like to start off by having some kind of microscopic basis or way of writing that stress tensor. The continuum mechanician says for a fluid that for a Navier-Stokes fluid, anyway, this stress is given by certain gradients of the velocity and the local pressure, and so on. But in a microscopic picture, you've got to start off with something like this. The force per unit volume in an atomic system is exerted only at the locations of the atoms, the R sub I, and there will be exerted on each atom as a result of the interaction with other atoms, there will be some potential force. This is a potential force, and as part of your microscopic definition of the system, you say you know what that is, how to calculate it from all the positions. From this relationship, you can crank a few wheels and infer an equation that I will now write down. Now, I'm sorry, even before I do that, I wanted to back up and say a few more things about the macroscopic description of the system. If you average over all the microscopic positions in some ensemble or spatial average, then the experimenters say that the stress exerted is proportional to this initial deformation, and more particularly, they say it's proportional to the symmetric part of it, because the anti-symmetric part corresponds to a rigid body rotation, times a function of time. Remember, the experiment is to deform, hold the surfaces rigid, and measure the force that you have to exert to hold those surfaces rigid as a function of time. This is the object of interest. It's called the stress relaxation modulus, and the integral is perhaps of special interest to some people, but won't be of a great deal of interest today. Its integral from 0 to infinity is the viscosity of the system. Okay. Now back to the microscopic calculation. Using this line, you can infer, and for me, the classical inference is always a paper by Irving and Kirkwood going back to the mid-1940s, right after World War II. But you see similar things like that in Lamb, and it must go back even further to the great figures in physics, but the neatest derivation I know of is this Irving and Kirkwood paper around 1946 or 7. What they came up with was an expression like this. First of all, you can associate a stress with every molecule in the system. I'm not proving this, by the way, and if you distract me and ask me to prove it, I'll attempt to do so, but it will take a long time and get off the track. You can establish approximately an expression like that where sigma lambda is given by first an expression valid for, say, liquid argon or solid argon, wouldn't matter, sum over nu, the distance between molecules lambda and nu, vector distance, multiplied by the force that molecule nu exerts on molecule lambda. I mean, by the position of molecule lambda, its center of mass or something like it. Wouldn't matter too much.
I have no problem with the notion of force on a nucleus, but I do have a problem with force on a molecule.
Can we build up from a nucleus to an atom? Can we say a force on an atom?
Well, you can just actually not.
Well, now I'm in trouble. the polymer is, for me, a string of atoms connected by bonds, and I assume that I'm allowed a classical mechanical description of the system in which I can really ignore the explicit existence of electrons and say that for...
That's the problem.
Is that your problem? Well, tell me more.
Well, I'd be glad to tell you more, but I don't want to interrupt you.
You said I am not entitled to proceed. You've got to tell me why.
I said that I have some differences. It's a subject that's been much discussed, and it's a long story. There's time at the end, I'll be back to it.
Okay. I, at least, am assuming that I can describe the position of every molecule by the positions of its atoms, and that I know how to write down a Hamiltonian for the system consisting of the kinetic energies of all of the masses and all the interatomic potential energies that I calculate from quantum mechanics, but I could also get from experiments if I didn't know quantum mechanics existed. Okay. That's the part that would exist even for liquid argon. For polymers, or for any systems with internal degrees of freedom, you have to add another part, which looks like the distance of each atom from the center of mass of the molecule and the force on that atom exerted by everything there in the system. And I sum here only over all the atoms in molecule lambda. Okay, I should back up and say... Yeah.
The first part looks very similar to Virial equation.
It does indeed.
If you, pressure for the static pressure.
It looks very similar, and if you took the average of this equation and calculated the trace of the stress tensor, you would get the equilibrium pressure. So that would be a familiar aspect of this, but in today's talk, we're interested in the off-diagonal components that give rise to shear stresses. Let me give some names to these. The total stress assigned to a molecule I will think of as 3. I will use superscripts on occasion for 3, the total. This part, the coupling part, 2, the stresses arising from intermolecular forces, and this part, which I will call probably a deformational part, I will call number 1. Intermolecular, not interatomic. In the polymer business, it is the custom to ignore the usual intermolecular stress and to claim that the total stress is not only this internal deformational part, but furthermore, it is the part of this deformational stress that arises solely from backbone stresses. Or backbone forces. That is, the vibrational potentials that keep the different atoms in the chain together. Neighbor forces that keep the bond length more or less fixed. Second neighbor forces that keep the bond angle more or less fixed. And commonly, one ignores all other forces. Okay, the backbone assumption. It's going to be the focus of one of my later criticisms of the Dawley-Edwards theory. One last thing to say about this division, and that is that this is an extremely dangerous expression, not so far as I know, because of the existence of quantum mechanics, but because of the existence of an assumption, this affine deformation with a very slow variation of position with a spatial, slow variation of deformation with position. You can measure the consequences of deformations like this. I do simulations, and it's very hard to do meaningful simulations of deformations like this. And the reason why, illustrated in terms of the same, well, let me go up here. In terms of the same diagram, in the simulation, you would study phenomena like this as fluctuations, or at least I am studying them as fluctuations in an equilibrium system. Study them using very sophisticated non-equilibrium techniques that give you the thing of interest, but don't give you any other information about the system, so I have stayed with equilibrium simulations. And if you imagine this kind of a deformation in what you have to use for simulations, namely a periodic boundary condition, then each of these cells of interest would be surrounded on all six sides by another system which would have to be a replica of the primitive cell. So you would have a deformation up here like this and a deformation down there like that. And you would be taking an extremely resistant system and forcing it to undergo strong and contrary deformations at a very sharp range, which is essentially an impossible task. So you have to use something fancier involving periodic waves in the simulations. Okay, now, the stress relaxation modulus. I said that was the thing of interest. How does it behave? Okay. I don't know how many of you have ever heard Bob Woodward give one of his blackboard talks. I once did, and though synthetic organic chemistry is a subject that I find pretty boring, he stood up there at the blackboard before 200 people and in a very small hand covered the board completely with many different colors of chalk and gave an utterly fascinating talk that almost persuaded me to give up theory and become a synthetic chemist. Not quite. In any case, for those of you who know me and are tempted to say, I knew Bob Woodward and you're no Bob Woodward, okay. I would like to factor out, before showing the experiments, KT times the monomer concentration in this polymeric system, or any intensive quantity that gives the right dimensionless units to C of T, something independent of molecular weight, anyway, and show you what C of T looks like for different systems. And I'm unable to give you orders of magnitude, which in any case I cribbed from John Ferry's book on mechanical properties. So let me just say this is a very big number for something like diamond. Probably decays a little bit, I'm not really positive, for very short times. Something like water doesn't differ at these short times by more than an order of magnitude or two from diamond, the hardest and an ordinary moderately soft liquid. Don't differ very much at time zero. But for water, the stress.
Viscosity, right?
I did.
And
the interval of G of T.
Yes. And what is the, how should we think of the viscosity of diamond?
You don't have to. because the integral of C of T for diamond would be infinite. This thing does never decay.
Not if it has defects.
Well, now you're getting into a subject which I don't understand, and that is the nature of crystals and solids. I've often told myself that a system, with a real system with defects, dislocations, whatever, should eventually be able to deform like glass. The people who think more deeply than I do say no. A solid, a crystal, has infinite order, or would if you construct the system in real life. And that infinite order might lead to some deformation of the distribution of vacancies, dislocations, and so on under stress, but it would not lead to flow. They would distinguish flow from movement of the vacancies. If anybody else wants to explain this in a better way, I'd be glad to hear it, because I've never read, I should say, people who said there are better explanations.
It's not been done very well.
Okay.
I think you pointed it exactly right, the right feature of it. Is that if you have something that is really solid, and unless you apply a large amount of stress to it, it will deform, and then it will do all kinds of interesting things if you do further experiments on it. If you apply a large enough stress, it presumably then it undergoes some sort of a transition to a plastic state. And then it will flow in the way you're talking.
But at least.
I think what you're saying is fine, although now that I'm saying something, I'm a little bit confused about your remark about periodic boundary conditions.
Well, the periodic boundary conditions had to do only with simulations, okay?
I know, but you can just repeat that sheer pattern.
Yeah, I have. Okay. I won't worry about that. In any case, I won't worry about this other question either, Mickey, because I don't know an extremely good answer anyway. Now, I was telling you.
I think diamond is a bad example for your purpose.
You don't like diamond.
I mean, in reality, in a laboratory, you will never get diamond to flow plastically.
I don't want it to flow plastically. I'm perfectly content. That it not.
All he's saying is that this thing stays up.
Yeah, I'm saying this stays constant.
So it's not really a viscosity.
It's an infinite number. It doesn't decay, so I presume you would say the viscosity is infinite. Rubber. Your ordinary rubber ball decays several orders of magnitude. Its value is at time zero. In a time that... maybe not picoseconds as here, but typically not more than nanoseconds, very fast. But it also stays constant and would have an infinite viscosity. If you want to say that's a meaningful statement, it would have to be that it's got a meaningful viscosity. Rubber. How does a rubber differ from a polymer melt or from a polymer solid? Rubbers are cross-linked. They have a three-dimensional structure. They are not permitted to flow indefinitely. Deform but not flow. A polymer without those crosslinks, a system of spaghetti, that is, cooked spaghetti, would decay with some decay constant. Put some numbers in, let's say that it decays pretty accurately as a single exponential, not exactly. Pretty closely to a single exponential from this plateau value. And how fast does it decay? Well, all over the map. These plateau values differ by 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 orders of magnitude. This relaxation for a flowing polymer fluid can vary anywhere from microseconds to years, depending on the molecular weight. The experiments will tell you that the disengagement time, they now call it, this relaxation time, is proportional to the 3.4 power of the number of monomer units in a polymer, with a pretty good accuracy. If they're feisty, they say 0.1. If they're not, they say 0.2, but pretty good. And since this chain length can vary over, 10 to the 4 orders of magnitude, and you're cubing it, you get quite a variation in relaxation time. You would correspondingly note, without any problem, that the viscosity is proportional to the 3.4 plus or minus 0.1. Okay, how do you explain that? Let me now take up the reputation model. But before leaving these equations, let me note that the plateau value for polymers or rubbers is often written in terms of the number of monomer units between entanglement points, and nobody quite knows what entanglement points are in a polymer, but they know for a rubber it's the location of those crosslink points, and this is the number of monomers along the backbone between those points. Okay, the reputation model. Pictorially, first of all, what one imagines is a tube in this model. The tube idea was first put forth in those words, I think, by Sam Edwards. But again, the words and the picture did not differ too much in previous years. This can be imagined to curl around in and out of the tube a little bit, but more or less confined to a tube of a certain diameter that represents the effects of entanglements. That is, the confinement of the motion of this polymer to the tube is supposed to be your way of incorporating the effects of entanglements between different chains. What Degen first brought to this field in, I think, the early 1970s, was a calculation of how long it takes a polymer chain to disengage from all those entanglements. And oversimplifying a bit, but not too much, he argued that you would calculate a diffusional time always by taking the length over which the system diffuses, dividing by a diffusion constant for motion or diffusional motion along the tube, and you would argue that this length is proportional to the number of monomer units in the chain, and that the friction with which any polymer chain resists diffusing back and forth along that tube is also proportional to chain length, and therefore the upshot is that D goes as 1 over chain length, and the disengagement time is n cubed. Okay, pretty close. But there is a second assumption, and as I go down this list of assumptions, of which I'm only going to mention 3, the foundation gets shakier and shakier in my view, and in the view of a few others. Number 2, the tube confers orientation. This is sort of a will become in the context of the third approximation anyway. It's sort of an interpretation or a completion of the definition of the tube. You imagine that for a certain length scale, anyway, maybe not for each monomer unit, but for a sufficient number of them, some finite number of them, as that section of the chain goes through any part of the tube, it acquires the orientation of that section of the tube. In other words, it acquires the deformation of that part of the tube. Now, putting that into an explicit calculation of the stress will come in a moment, so let me just leave that in some terms. Well, the moment has arrived. Assumption number 3 is one I mentioned before, and that is that sigma total can be restricted to what I will call sigma 4, the backbone stress, and I will now write down an expression for it. And I will do so only for a fairly simple model, the so-called freely jointed chain model of polymer physics, in which the polymer chain is regarded as a string of bonds connected by unconstrained joints. That is, successive bonds may orient any way without any potential variation as a result of this bond angle. Okay. For such a model, the backbone assumption, which ignores all other contributions to the stress, says that for any chain lambda, you may calculate the stress by adding up the vector distance, the vector that represents the bond, times the vector tension in the bond. This is the bond vector, BM. And F is the tension in the bond. And if you say that these are not real bonds, but collections of real bonds, and you're entitled to use what's called the Gaussian model of a chain, in which all that counts is that you get the right mean square end-to-end distance for some section of bonds, then this boils down to 3kBT over bond vector squared and averaged, times BM, the bond vector dyadic. That's the usual assumption in polymer physics. Okay, I consider that to be the most questionable, but it is in this context that use is made of this tube confers orientation assumption. Each bond vector, as it goes through a section of the tube, acquires, in some measure anyway, the orientation of that. Yeah?
And you have diffusion along the length, and you have transverse diffusion. What assumptions implicit or otherwise are made about changes in the tube as the polymer is making its way through the tube? The tube is due to its neighbors.
The original assumption, and the one that you'll see in Doy and Edwards' book, a very beautiful book, by the way, is that this tube is completely rigid. There is some measure of transverse fluctuation, but it's a finite amplitude. It doesn't count compared to the very large length scales that you're interested in. Now, there have been some elaborations of that picture. I don't want to go into them because they don't change any of the quantitative predictions. I'm sorry, they don't change any of the qualitative predictions about the stress relaxation modulus. They don't change the powers or anything like that. Okay, how do they justify this last assumption? Let me just give you an opinion poll of myself only. I consider this to be a quite reasonable assumption. If there is a tube, I don't see any problem in saying that's the disengagement time. This people have questioned. There have been a lot of simulations to observe the actual fluctuations in tube orientation and diameter and so on. It's up in the air as far as simulations. It's a very hard problem because in a real polymer system, these tubes have very large diameters. There are big fluctuations in real systems. And all that counts is that the model be correct over some finite distance. And that could be very large. If you go back to this number of entanglement, number of bonds between entanglements, for real systems, if you measure this in monomer units, it's typically 100. These things are very far apart. They allow lots of fluctuations. It's very hard to look at that with simulations. Okay. What's wrong with that? First, let me tell you why Doy and Edwards say that it is okay. It is because a good theorist should be interested only in the representative significant features of the problem, and for this system, those features are that the polymer is skinny and long. That may be tautological, but don't bother me. It's skinny and long, and in the limit, where you go to an infinitely thin polymer chain, then, way back to the beginning, where you could have said that between each pair of atoms, there is a vector distance and a force that one atom exerts on the other, and that this would have been a good expression for the total stress. You could have argued that because the forces that one chain exerts on another are exerted over a distance shrinking to zero, that there can be no contribution to the stress of interest from such context. Yes. Do you want to get the forces, the stresses, I'm sorry, due to the interactions of one polymer chain with another? The stresses don't come into existence until one piece of this chain exerts a force on that chain. As you shrink the diameter of these rods to zero, that force is exerted over a distance, Rij, going to zero. And therefore, such contributions vanish. If you don't accept that argument and say, gee, that's right, good for you, because I don't accept it either, but that's the nature of the argument that says throw away these other terms and save that. I mean, that and the success of the theory, which may or may not be a strong argument. In any event, I didn't like that, and I had some doubts about this, and that's what got me into simulations. Let me first mention some other motivations that have gotten people into simulations and to variations on the theory. First of all, the theory gives you 3.4. So the theory gives you 3. The experiments give you 3.4. The experimentalists will swear by this number. They say, that's it. With a few exceptions who say, I would like to study this further, but the NSF won't give me any money to go to higher molecular weights. Most of the theorists, at least those who like reptation theory, say that if you could go to higher molecular weights, then this would decrease from 3.4 to 3. And there are many quantitative theories over why something like this should be observed for medium molecular weights, and then you would eventually recover on the Degen calculation. I don't know what to make of that. There are a few attempts to rationalize this discrepancy based on cooperative phenomena between different chains. I think there are rationalizations after the fact in terms of a very vague set of models. Generally speaking, what people try to arrive at is n to the 3 and 1/3, and there is sort of an exponent out there that people think might be relevant, and this exponent 3 and 1/3 is the time it takes for a collection of diffusing Brownian particles to all leave a sphere in which they're initially contained, a sphere of radius proportional to the square root of n, because that's the radius of gyration of a polymer chain, and leave it get all for the first time. Okay. So it may be relevant. It does seem like the sort of thing that might be, but the models are very vague.
This exponent comes from the first assumption, which you liked, not from the second two, which you don't like.
This 3 comes...
I thought you said from the first
assumption. Oh, it does. I do like that. So you're saying...
So,
but I am not the one trying to get around this. I am saying that there's more going on that has not been taken into account. So trying to rationalize the discrepancy in terms of anything up to point 3 is hopeless. And I'll give you my arguments for that in a moment. There are other questions. The theory shows much less effect due to molecular wave heterogeneity than the experiments do. De Clauseau, in particular, has constructed a fairly elaborate set of reasons for invoking some cooperative behavior, at least at a certain level, involving binary chains. Okay, let me just very briefly get on to the simulations and a few results. The model that I have simulated is a Langevin model. The chain is constructed of sticks with 90-degree bond angles between them. My sticks will each be 25 units long. Units of what? Don't ask. It doesn't matter. Or if it does matter to you, say angstroms. 25 angstroms long, 90-degree bond angles. There is a solvent in which all these different chains are immersed. There is a frictional interaction with the solvent, represented by the beads at the vertices of this polymer chain. There are N beads in a polymer chain, and there are enough different polymer chains in my simulation system that one polymer chain rather rarely extends further from one end to the other than the primitive cell that you use for the simulations. Very rarely, but I cannot say never. I don't have the computational resources to take a system that large. These are literally flexible, but with an extremely small amount of flexibility. I allow a few degrees mean square fluctuation. These are freely jointed chains. In other words, if this is one bond, the bond angle is vibrating a little bit, but it can rotate. The dihedral angle is completely free. Can't straighten out. What else do I need to say? I'm not literally looking at polymer melts. Typically, I've used chains typically on the order of 1.5 angstroms to 2 angstroms in thickness, so that I get an aspect ratio of about 15 to 1, long and skinny. And I use on the order of, I've gone up to about 256 beads, 255 bonds. The volume fraction of the systems is typically 0.01. So these solutions are mostly solvent. They are concentrated polymer solutions, however, because there are enough of them there at a sufficiently high concentration that they overlap and interfere with each other's motion. In my opinion, it is. And not by this measure of volume fraction, but by all other phenomena, all viscoelastic phenomena.
Do you intend to be testing assumptions that explicitly require a melt?
None of these assumptions explicitly require a melt. They would all be made in exactly the same way and are made for a concentrated polymer solution. So I use the melt only in vague terms, a flowing concentrated polymer solution.
Well above overlap concentration.
Well above overlap. Let me talk about the results. One of the first things you might want to look at is another consequence of this tube reptation model, and that is the translational diffusion constant. It is, according to that model, this is a translational self-diffusion constant. You label a single molecule and watch its diffusion. It should go as 1 over n squared. I am prohibited, I was told, from showing you slides, so I'll draw things, and you're free to say I drew them in some misleading way if you like, but it wouldn't be polite. There's only one theoretical curve you can draw for these results, and that is the one you get at very low molecular weights and very low concentrations, where the total frictional constant of a molecule is just the sum of all the bead friction constants that you assign. That's up here. for the typical results that I'll show you, you get curves looking like this, deviating by about half a dozen or so powers of E. And again, that I use E and not 10 is not a mathematician's fancy. It's because I can afford E, but I can't afford 10. Okay, half a dozen is not unfair. You get to a pretty good level of accuracy, this n to the minus 2 power.
That's a better straight line than your x-axis, so it's impressive.
There is extensive interference and a significant drop by many powers of E from the free diffusion. There's another aspect that one wants to verify, not only that one has entanglements that interfere, one would like to have as close as one can a thermodynamically ideal solution, because the theorist's ambition is to realize this limit of topological constraints where the chains are infinitely thin. There are a couple of measures you can use for that. You can look at the mean square end-to-end distance. It turns out to be close to the ideal value, that is proportional to the number of bonds with the right proportionality constant. You can look at the radius of the radial distribution function between two different polymer chains, lambda and nu, versus their distance. It should be one, everybody believes, for a concentrated solution, despite the existence of repulsion. In some measure, because of the finite size, it should be one, because the chains don't care whether they, nu does not care whether it overlaps lambda or any other chain, so it makes no difference. And it's pretty close to one until you get within about one or two bond lengths. Pretty close to ideal. Now, what do you get for the stress relaxation modulus or its various components? Well, I erased the crucial graph, the crucial equations, rather, that identifies the different contributions. So let me write. Sure.
Here you get the diffusion constant, which goes as 1 over n squared, right?
Yep.
And here you argue that it's supposed to go as 1 over n.
This is for diffusion along the contour, this curved contour. And it's a short time, this whole phenomenon that you're describing disappears when that particular chain leaves the tube. This is different. As the chain goes out of one tube, it goes into another, and so on for a very long time. And it's that very long time process that you're trying to describe.
I'm not saying you're finding a contradiction.
There is no contradiction.
You know, it's a longer time.
It's a longer time. I was going to remind you of the total, the deformational and the intermolecular. and this, a piece of this, and I should be careful, a piece of this, the backbone piece, is used in the reptation model, and this is neglected. But I should be very careful and honest. It does not say that the, in this model, one does not say that the deformational contribution is what's significant. One says only that the backbone part of the deformational stress is significant. Well, what do you get? C of T versus T. The example I'm going to quickly sketch for you is for a chain of 128 beads, volume fraction, as I said before, 0.01, and you're a simulator, you'll want to know that there so quite a few degrees of freedom. Quite a few, especially considering that one has to go to very long times to get anything of interest. Time is the axis. And what is the time scale? Well, let's say 0, 100, 200. What does that mean? Let me characterize the time scale by saying that in the units I'm using, if you take a single bond out of the chain with those same bead friction constants and just let it bounce around all by itself, the rotational relaxation time for that single bond would be 0.625. It would be the square of the bond length. I've divided by 1,000. Did I hear? No. Okay. If you save all, you get a curve that looks like that. Well, it doesn't really look like that. There are a lot of bumps in it. Forget that. Three, the total. One, the part that contains the part. That's very significant. Deformational. Two, suppose you save. It is, as you say, literally a lot of CT.
I don't think that's how you're separating one thing out.
Okay, let me say it. C is a correlation, an autocorrelation between stresses. If I save everything that contributes to the stress, I get what I call curve three. If I throw away the intermolecular stress, yeah, this is purely simulation. If I throw away the intermolecular stress, I get something that decays very rapidly to a negligible amount. If I save only two, then I should get something very close to three, unless there were some weird cross-correlation between the parts one and two. But there seems to be no such weird cross-correlation. And, you know, within big bumps, within the noise, I get the same thing. That does not mean that the backbone stress is negligible. Let me show it. Short time doesn't mean anything because they're just different contributions to the short time forces. But you get something at long time. As to as long a time as I can go. This is for a homogeneous system. This is four. Backbone only. What do you make of that? Well, it's fairly obvious, and maybe that means it's not too significant, that one, the deformational stress, should vanish. If I am a deformed polymer chain, I'm stretched by this experimenter, and I try to relax. When I try to do so, I'm going to meet these other chains. They're going to slow down my motion. It will exert forces equal and opposite to the force, my internal backbone force, that wants to make me contract to my normal state. And because they're exerted at the right points and over the right distances, that at least one rationalizes afterward. That's obvious, and it must happen. But when it does happen, that means that it is this this intermolecular stress, too, just like in liquid argon, although with a quite different molecular basis. But just like that formally, that is a big contribution to the stress relaxation modulus. You can go on. There are other experiments. I've done binary mixtures. The backbone stress does not reflect. Indeed, I put in some 32 bead chains in this mixture. And the backbone stress curve does not change much at all. The actual total curve goes something like this. Big difference due to the heterogeneity. That's probably all I want to say, except that what's missing here to make this subject interesting again to anybody besides myself and one or two others is some way of calculating the intermolecular forces and stresses that arise for this topological limit. If you have two different chains, which I would like to illustrate with two different colors of chalk, which you can't. And they're infinitesimally thin, then any relative separation is equally likely on the average. On the other hand, when you deform the chains and look at their relaxation, then they start interfering and forces arise. There are fluctuating forces that can contribute to a autocorrelation function in the simulations or to a stress in the experiment, but their average is zero. Not the average of their product, their average all alone. And that makes this a rather funny kind of force, very hard to theorize about. And the closest I've seen is a paper by Sam Edwards and Iwata, once his postdoc and once mine, who have between them calculated a second virial coefficient in some kind of funny way. It should be zero, but they've imposed constraints to keep the dots tied, as it were. That's the most relevant thing, but it's not relevant enough because the fluctuations that you would really like to theorize about here are taking place in a not in vacuum between two chains, but with these immersed in a whole sea of like chains, which constrains the way they can relax, and it's that relaxation that you're interested in. So anyway, that's the end of my story. I thank you for listening. If anybody will solve this problem this afternoon, I would really appreciate it.